So I picked Mary Oliver's poem. I read it for a talk some while ago, not too long ago, but I haven't read it in a long, long time. And so when I read it, it just reminded me of how important it is to practice with a level of simplicity. And that's what I really want to talk about. I want to see if we can begin to talk about simplicity in our practice and how much simplicity is there in our practice. Dhamma itself is a relatively simple thing. It's quite simple. I shouldn't even say relatively simple. It's quite simple. And it seems like the Satipatthana, the whole thing the Buddha was ever pointing to was this ability to be with the present moment, just feel into the present moment, however it is. And I've been noticing how complicated my actual relationship with present moment can get. It can get pretty complicated. I kind of practice in a way that moves oftentimes away from simplicity and into more complicated things. And so many of you know me, but many of you don't know me. And so I thought I would talk about this becoming more simple in my practice and tell you a little bit about me at the same time. So you kind of understand how this is the first time I've ever been here. And you kind of get to know me and at the same time begin to see how the simplicity of practice shows up. Because before I came to the Dhamma, I lived a pretty complicated life. My parents were very dysfunctional, and their dysfunctionality showed up in the rest of us because there were 10 of us. And so we had a lot of difficulty knowing exactly how to be and what to be to keep them from freaking out. And so there was a way in which our lives, you had to hold a lot of information at the tip of your fingers or at the tip of your mind so you could shift and change and rearrange things depending on how they were. So if my mother was in a good mood, things would be good, but you had to be prepared for something that could easily shift her and change her whole mood, and everything had to shift. The same with my father. He was very much more impulsive than my mother was. So from the time of my life, I lived in this kind of precarious way of holding life as a impulsive, reactive thing and holding a lot of information at the same time. All the way through my college years and raising two boys, I was a single parent for a long time. And so raising two boys, same thing, holding everything in my life in this precarious kind of having to have my whole world in front of me all the time. And what I could say was not present was simplicity. Everything was fine-tuned to know exactly why things were, and everything had to be in a particular place. Everything was stacked up neatly on top of each other. Or as I like to say, I would just put some of my difficulties down in a little box, tie it up, and stick it in a closet. Just tie it up, stick it in a closet. I went all the way through law school like this. I never really, just don't worry about nothing. We'll get through it. I tell the boys, we're going to be fine. Don't worry. Tie it up. Put it in a box. Stick it in the closet. That's all we have to do. Don't worry about it. Just let that go. And this closet that I was putting everything in, you can imagine, was getting pretty filled up. Pretty filled up. But we don't know that that's what's happening. Maybe a different way to think about it is, you know how the body takes in food and then digests it and gets rid of what it doesn't need? But sometimes it'll store certain vitamins and minerals till when it can use it in sparse amounts, or it will store up fat cells in case I need to have more energy for something else. It stores up little parts, little things. It saves a little bit of the water that's in the stuff we consume so that it can keep the body fluid. It knows how to do this. It knows how to store up energy too. Knows how to store up memories. Knows how to store up experiences. So when I say I was putting these little things in a box, tying a little bow on it and sticking it in the closet, what that means in reality was I was storing all these little things inside me, putting it here in the shoulder, putting it here in the back of the knee, sticking it in the back a little bit, and the body was just finding places to hold all these things that I could not look at, could not deal with. And then I took the bar, got out of law school, went all the way to law school. I was very smart and it was all about school. And that's all I was doing was going to school. Everything's going to be great as soon as I get out of law school. And of course, I get out of law school, I take the bar and I failed it. That did not go with the plan. So as far as I was concerned, the bar is a racist thing. It's all the bar's fault. It didn't really have anything to do with me because I'm smart. I've been smart my whole life. I'll just take the bar a second time and then I'll pass it. Studied really, really hard. Took the bar the second time and failed it a second time. And when I failed the bar the second time, it was probably the worst time of my life and the greatest time of my life, all blended in together. Because in that moment, I could no longer pretend. It's like the door, the closet door opened up and all the boxes fell out. And I couldn't get them back in the way I had put them in originally. All of a sudden, all the stuff, all of my understanding of what I thought the world was supposed to be like, it was not. And I got stuck in this kind of, what exactly does it mean that I failed the bar? What does that say about me? What does that say about my life that I'm living? What does it say? That I'm not okay? It was just such a strange and weird time. And I remember going to the store, getting a book about, I wanted to find a book about life being messed up and you could still be happy. Not how to be happy when your life is messed up, but this acknowledgement that life was crappy, it's not going to change any, but you could be happy. That is what I was looking for. Surely there's a book like that. And I went to all these self-help books because I'm the queen of self-help, and they all kind of pointed to this kind of, you can fix your own life and you can make your life better. And I had already tried all that. It didn't work. And I still failed the bar. I did eventually pass the bar the third time. But I think it's because of what happened in between that second bar and taking it the third time, I began to understand. I found a book, Trungpa Rinpoche's Lojan Practice. It's a Tibetan practice, but it was 59 slogans. And some of you know, I used to read a slogan a night and sit and do what I called meditation, trying to understand what these slogans were pointing to. But what began to happen, this was like sort of my stepping into practice. I had originally started practicing in the mid 80s, what I called practice, but it was in the 90s when I failed the bar that I decided to really just find a way to meditate, to get still, to see the world differently. And the thing that began to happen was this simplification of my life. It's kind of a strange phenomena because I was beginning to see my life more and more and more and more and more clearly is what I was beginning to see. I began to see how I put things in boxes. I began to see what I was actually doing. And the more I saw that, the more kind of shedding that began to happen, which is what happens, this kind of purification that happens in the Dhamma. But even in the course of doing all of that, the practice itself, I started getting interested in Dhamma itself. So I would get very nerdy and I would just look online and study about everything. And instead of me getting more and more and more connected to just stillness, I began to think more and more about the practice, try to figure it out, try to understand it. And the practice itself became this convoluted, heavy-weighted, very, very difficult, hard-to-bear thing, which I could never seem to, what I expected of practice and what was happening were two different things. So as I got deeper and deeper into practice and I found my way to Seattle Insight, now practice was this convoluted thing of trying to make myself peaceful. That's what, very simple, peaceful. I just need to make myself peaceful. And I had anxiety all the time, just constant anxiety. And I'm trying to make myself peaceful. And the more I tried to be peaceful, the more anxiety I had. I would go to teachers. And every time a teacher would come to Seattle Insight, I would ask them, you know, there's a hindrance called restlessness. And I would ask them, well, how do you work with restlessness? And they would give instructions on working with restlessness. And I would try it. And sometimes it would work, but most times it didn't. I just kept staying restless. And so there's this complicated process begin to unfold on how to get rid of anxiety, how to work with this hindrance of restlessness. And it got very complicated and very, I don't know, very judgy, very difficult. 3 years I had this anxiety. 3 years I tried figuring it out. I have a lawyer's mind, so I figure out everything. And my entire relationship with practice was about figuring it out. I don't know how much you guys read the suttas, though. But about maybe, maybe 3 or 4 years maybe 5 years into Sims. I begin to notice the suttas, start reading them, and I begin to see some things that I hadn't seen before. One, the Buddha didn't talk like we do. We have a way of talking, but the Buddha didn't talk like that. We, as teachers, we have a way of explaining the Dhamma. People will ask questions, well, like me, how do I work with this restlessness? And we will talk about what to do, the antidotes to restlessness and how to work with restlessness and this kind of idea that somehow restlessness, in order for my practice to be good, should somehow be taken care of. And I shouldn't have restlessness anymore. But the Buddha didn't really talk like that. The way the Buddha would talk, if you asked him a question, I think on, what do I do about this restlessness? He would say, well, suppose a person were looking in water and it's clear and smooth water so that they could see their identity. They could see the true nature of who they were. And then sometimes you could look in water and it would be agitated, stirred up so that you could not see your face, your reflection in the water. What? That's about restlessness? He wouldn't really talk about how to fix something or how to, and sometimes he didn't how to practice with it. What he would talk about is the distinction between its presence and its absence. And all these suttas that the Buddha talked about, all these different lists that we practice with, it was more of him saying, this is what it looks like when it's present. This is what it looks like when it's absent. Let's say you want to ask him about the three characteristics. Okay, how do I deal with, understand the three characteristics? You gave a teaching on the three characteristics. How do I understand that? He wouldn't give a long, drawn-out explanation. He would say, well, suppose a person were struck by an arrow. And they would experience an unpleasant sensation. And a well-trained disciple would know the experience as it is. They would not get elated or dejected by elated by a pleasant feeling or dejected by an unpleasant feeling. They would see it as it truly is. They would see it that it is subject to change, that it's dukkha, impermanent. It's not personal. But suppose a regular person, were to get struck by an arrow, they would not see that it was impermanent, subject to change, and not personal. They would be elated by pleasant feelings and dejected by unpleasant feelings. And they would get caught in the mind. That doesn't really tell you what the three characteristics are. Do you see the difference in the way that he talked about it? The way we talk about a lot of Dhamma is we share a lot of conceptual understandings of what it is. But the way the Buddha talked about Dhamma was just pointing you to how you could tell if it were present or if it were not. So over the years, I have begun to see that the practice of Dhamma itself is not about how do I fix some moment to make my moments peaceful, calm, better. And instead, it is this awareness of what is going on in the moment. It's very simple. Meaning that I stop worrying about whether or not my Dhamma is good or bad. I stopped worrying about whether my sits were good sits or bad sits. Instead, I just want to know what is arising in this sit and what is absent in this sit. I don't care if restlessness is present. I mean, I got to investigate restlessness anyway. I want to know what it is. And so there's a constant kind of just being with phenomena and experience, however it shows up. See, this is what I think Mary Oliver is pointing to. And this is what I think my practice has pointed to over the years. It's a very simple thing. It's a very complicated thing in our ordinary minds, but it's very simple in Dhamma. Do you know what is arising, what is passing away? That's it. There is no grandiose understanding that requires deep, deep, deep study. You can do deep, deep, deep study, and there's all kinds of things you can learn. But in terms of us as householders and practitioners, do you know what's arising? Do you know what's present? Do you know when there's ill will? How often do we know there's ill will and we try to get rid of it? But do you know there's ill will? Or sometimes we don't even know there's ill will. I just don't feel good, and I try to make myself feel good. I don't know why I don't feel good. I just try to make myself feel good. But there's a way in practice that the more simplified you make it, the wiser you become. And I think that simplified way is simply the knowing of when something is present and the knowing of when it's absent. That's it. You know what this has done for me, this simplification? I can't believe how little I judge my practice, unlike I used to. I used to judge it all the time, whether I was doing good enough or whether I need more learning. I had more doubt. But now I have this way of being in practice that affords me a level of peace like the trees. They don't care what shows up. They're just alive with whatever shows up as it shows up. I don't scold myself when a hindrance shows up and, you know, I'm trying to meditate and I'm sleepy or I'm sitting there thinking the whole time. I don't scold myself when I don't pat myself on the back when the mind is clear and I seem to can stay right there with an object. What I have come to accept that the greatest gift you can give yourself as a practitioner is to treat everything that comes to you as being on the path. And as being part of learning to discern the distinctions in Dhamma. I want to read one more poem before I close, and then we can ask, you know, open it up to some questions and see what you say. This is another... this is another poem that I love dearly. I have to read it to myself every once in a while. It's called Under Ideal Conditions by Al Zolinas. Such a beautiful poem. He says, say in the flattest part of North Dakota, on a starless, moonless night, no breath of wind, very still. A person could light a candle, then walk away. Every now and then, they could turn and see the candle burning. 17 miles later, provided conditions remained ideal, they could still see the flame. Somewhere between the 17th and the 18th mile, they would lose the light. If they were walking backwards, they would know the exact moment when they lost the flame. They could step forward and find it again. Back and forth, dark to light, light to dark. Where's the place where the light disappears, where the light reappears? Don't tell me about photons and eyeball reflection and refraction. Don't tell me about 186,000 miles per second and the theory of relativity. All I know is that place where the light appears and disappears. That's the place where we live. This is the same thing I think Mary Oliver is pointing to. This is what I'm trying to point to this evening, is to consider how simple is your practice. Are you trying to figure it out? Or are you just learning to distinguish when something is present and when it's not? So let's sit a moment. All right. Let's see if anyone has any comments or questions. Yeah, go ahead. Is it Bill or Barbara?
Well, maybe both of us, but certainly okay. I've never heard anybody state this approach quite in this way. And it's really, I'm going to have to give this quite a bit of thought. This is really, really amazing. Thank you so much. This is really astonishing.
Well, I would add that a lot. I mean, I have felt so often that I think I'm practicing and there's all this complexity. And all of a sudden, oh, this is dukkha, or this is something else arising, and it's suddenly the feeling of simplification, you know, and then it's not simple anymore. But to sort of distill it into how you describe it, I think is so important. And thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. I Forter? That's a kind of a strange name there. Not sure who that is. You hear me?
Hello. Hi, Tallulah. Is it Tuar?
Tuare.
I apologize for not knowing how to pronounce your name because took a class with you and Will a while ago, which was great. So I loved your talk, and I had an interesting experience. And first of all, I can totally relate to what you said about compartmentalizing and denying. And I also had a pretty dysfunctional childhood, 7 of us, not quite as many as you. But I had a really tough beginning of this year because I suffered some losses but they were minorish, but they brought up some older stuff. And what you said today really resonated with me. I got through it through my practice. absolutely by being with it and just it, not trying to change it and just really understanding that, you know, kind of seeing the light instead of identifying with the pain. And there was a lot of pain, but the practice really got me through it in a way that I feel like stronger than I ever have. So anyway, I wanted to just say thank you for your talk because it totally reminded me of just that concept of, you know, everything you said makes so much sense about how the Buddha talks. And it's not about, you know, it's annoyingly not straightforward, but it's also
it's not straightforward.
And just that, like, you don't see, you know, you don't see when you're suffering, you think you are the suffering and you're really not. It's a lie. And so I just really loved your talk. Thank you so much. Sorry to come on with no makeup and my hair looking crappy, but.
Oh, no, you're fine. You're fine. You're fine. We're good. You know, there's a sutta that I love. I love a lot of suttas, but one of my favorite is this deva that comes to the Buddha. And all these devas and spirit beings would come to the Buddha late at night when it'd be like 3 o'clock in the morning. And they would say that the Buddha was sitting in the dark of the night. And then the whole grove, he was usually in Jetta's Grove and on Ananda Pindaka's monastery. And then the whole grove would light up. And, you know, you can kind of see this when you go out in retreat centers where there's no lights. And all of a sudden you can look down, like especially at IMS, you go outside, and you look down the street, it's no lights, period. You look down the other way, no lights, period. I'm not going nowhere. I'm barely going to be outside. But Buddha would be sitting out in this pitch black night. And then the grove would light up with all kinds of brilliance. And it would be a spirit that would come to ask him a Dhamma question the same way we would. And this one spirit, she came and asked him how he crossed the floods, the rapids, it's called the floods that they're asavas. It's this energy that sweeps us away. We can see it in our own lives. We get swept away with stuff. Something happens and all of a sudden we're swept away into some kind of energy and we're lost. And so it happens too quick for us to even stop it. So she was asking him, how did you cross that, kind sir? And he said, this is his answer, great wise Buddha. I crossed the floods by not pushing forward and not standing still. And she said, okay, but sir, thank you. But how did you not cross forward and not stand still? And his answer, for clarification, in case you didn't get the first part of it, he said, when I pushed forward, I got entangled. When I stood still, I sank. So I crossed the floods by not pushing forward and not standing still. She understood him. She thanked him and she left. But do you see the difference between that kind of an answer and the way that we practice or expect the Dhamma to clarify itself for us so much so we understand exactly what's going on? But I think what he was pointing to her is, when you're in the floods, can you notice, are you pushing forward or are you standing still? Are you getting entangled? Are you sinking? You got to know that. And if you begin to notice that, you can begin to see how to move without pushing forward and without standing still. But you can't understand that unless you're in a flood moving through it. Unless you know you are being swept away by a flood and somehow or another you are not judging the flood and just being aware, noticing what's happening in your practice. It's such a simpler way of practicing. It doesn't involve this kind of thinking mind, figuring it out, trying to understand all this. It involves being willing to feel what's going on. I feel swept away. I feel like I'm lost in thought. I feel like I've somehow left my sit. What have I? And noticing the felt sense when you're present and alert and ardent. And what does it feel like when you're lost in thought? And letting the felt sense of the body actually tell you where you are. It's such a different way of practicing. I mean, it's really Philip that allowed me to feel this way. I've always been a felt sense person, but I didn't have a teacher that encouraged that kind of way of looking at the Dhamma. I always, most of the lawyer mind and most of my teachers seem to fit within that lawyer way of being. Let me figure it out. And Philip was the first teacher that came along that was okay with just feeling your way through and not judging what you're feeling, rather knowing what you're feeling and using the felt sense as a way to distinguish the presence and absence of whatever was there. How often do you think about the absence of wanting or the absence of not wanting? We only get caught up when there's wanting, and then we got to figure out how to get rid of that. But if you begin to notice what the body feels like when there's no wanting in the mind, when there's no not wanting, when you're energized and interested, even if you're watching TV, have you ever noticed? What does it feel like when I'm interested in the TV show and I'm actually watching it? And what does it feel like when I'm not interested and I'm bored and I don't really care, just kind of flipping through the channel, whatever? What does it feel like when you're reading a book and you're really interested? That interest is the same interest that can show up in a sit. And you can tell, do I feel interested in this sit? Or am I just doing it out of discipline, by rote? This is what I do first thing in the morning. Not really interested. Really just using it to think my way through and plan my day. Or am I really interested here, present, ardent? Your body is way older than you are. Way, 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 way older than you are. It's been around for several thousands of years. And it knows how to do all kinds of things. It doesn't need your input in it at all. And you can stay alive. But the mind is very short window of knowledge based on only our lifetimes. And we use the mind as our guide rather than this body. We use our ordinary thinking mind, which is very limited in its understanding, rather than the body that has thousands of years of wisdom. And really, I think I'm just encouraging you to rely more on the body. It knows what's happening. It knows. And that's where we're putting our support. You see? It's a little different, but it is a lot simpler. The body doesn't really get into a lot of drama. You know, it doesn't care what sounds it hears. You hear what I'm saying? It doesn't care whether that's construction sound or whether that is a baby laughing. It doesn't care. It's just sound. And it's the mind that decides that construction noise is bad and the baby giggling is good. But to the ears, it's just sound. Doesn't care. So if we begin to let the body tell us what's arising without all the mental application over it, we can begin to see some distinctions and get less caught up in trying to make our practice unfold a certain way and get more like what Philip says. We can let the Dhamma do us. Anyway, so we're going to run out of time here. Quite beautiful to be here. I appreciate you. I appreciate you listening to me. I hope I helped you consider practicing in a much more simpler way. Great. Really is very, very simple. So I hope I see you again, retreats or wherever we are. I hope I see you again.